Meeting to order. It is.
I sit here since Anderson's not going to be here.
It is 8:05 on July 26th.
She knows where she is in space.
We do have myself, Representative Wilson, Representative Seaton, and Representative Gardner. And Representative Gatto is on his way. We don't have to have a quorum today because this is really a work session, but we do have many of the members that went with us to Denver as we went through our, actually it was a conference on how to spend health care dollars wisely. And Senator Davis was on that committee. Also, Pauline Swanson is here with us today. Charles Burnham is here. Commissioner Carlene Jackson, Stephanie Birch, Pat Carter, Jerry Fuller is online. Denny DeWitt was on the committee also. I don't see him. And that's pretty much everybody, wasn't it? And, Representative Cisna. She just joined us. She just snuck in. She went with us to Denver, too. And so what these meetings are, that we're going to have one every month for the next several months, and they're pulling together the things that we learned about in Denver, looking at several aspects of each category. And today's, we're going to have two categories today, but we were unable to, because of conflicts, to be able to pull together the, wasn't it the mental health aspects that we were, chronic diseases. So anyway, so Stephanie Birch is going to give us from the Division of Public Health what she has pulled together here on improving birth outcomes. And after she gets done with this, we're going to look at different aspects of it, see what we can do to save money. And that's our goal. We're going to look at ways that we can continue with the services if we can, if it's a program that is proof that it's going well and that it's accomplishing what it was set out to accomplish. And then we're going to just talk about it and talk about the different things that we can do maybe to increase services in ways that will prevent some of the costs that we encounter along the way when we don't do that. So, and in the long run, that will save money. So what we'll, start right off with Stephanie. She is an RN and mental health.
No. Maternal child fetal health.
Okay, Stephanie, I'll tell you, let you say who you are and what you do, and then we will hear your presentation.
Good. Good morning. Thank you, Representative Wilson. I'm Stephanie Birch, and I'm the section chief for Women's, Children's, and Family Health. My background is as a nurse and almost an advanced practice nurse. I'm finishing up my family nurse practitioner right now, and I have 25 years in maternal child and neonatal health. Primarily working in an acute care setting. There's a couple more there. And so as I had understood, since I'm the first one out of the chute here to do this presentation, what I've provided for you are about 7 slides of what I would consider to be indicators around our performance that we measure in our, as one of the activities of what my section provides. And then some, not so much program information per se, but indicators around birth and outcomes that I think are important for our representation to be aware of. And then some discussion about solutions, because I think that that is what you wanted to have a lot of discussion about. So I'll start with that. There we go. So the first slide is about prenatal care. And the reason why I think that this is really important, we define prenatal care as the initiation of care, the infrequency or frequency of visits. And our challenge right now is that the number of visits that women get during their pregnancy is really considered to be not meeting the national standard and certainly not the Healthy People Goal 2010, which is really what our targets are for many of our performances. As you can see, Alaska has not made progress towards achieving Healthy People goals, and the way we're able to measure this is that we look at the number of visits recorded on the birth certificates, and we've been able to analyze this data over many, many years. And it does indicate in our review, which is done through the Pregnancy Risk Associate Monitoring System, which is also known as PRAMS, that 1 in 5 women did not get care as early as they wanted. And nearly 1 in 3 Alaska women deliver an infant that received less than adequate prenatal care, and 1 in 7 nearly no care at all. So we have a lot of women coming into labor and delivery who have had absolutely no prenatal care whatsoever, and quite a large proportion of them. Did you have a question, Representative Wilson?
Stephanie, is it because they're too far away from where they need to go get the care?
Well, we'll be sort of talking a little bit about that, but what we find in our reasons that PRAMS has indicated is that they had a lack of knowledge that they were pregnant during their first trimester, which is the first 12 weeks of pregnancy. There's a lack of insurance or funds, and that far outweighs many of their reasons, and the lack of access in their community. Now, I think with the initiation of the community health centers and the federally qualified health centers, that's going to be helpful for women both to determine if they're, in fact, they're pregnant, and also to get early prenatal care. But the number of providers that are trained in providing good early prenatal care is really limited in terms of access and tends to be available more in our population centers. So that's a challenge for us.
Do they have it in the villages? Because they have their own health care, so do they, how does that work there?
Yeah, Representative Wilson, they have community health aid providers in the village clinics, and they're trained on some very basics of prenatal care. And then intermittently, they, if they receive prenatal care, they intermittently go into some of the regional hubs and for visits intermittently. So there's a value, I think, partly in terms of we have issues with values around prenatal care. In our urban centers, what's interesting is that many of our providers would rather not see a woman until she's in her second trimester of care because of payment. And so you miss that window, the first 12 weeks of pregnancy, to really affect behavioral change where you can screen for smoking and get them into smoking cessation. You can screen them for alcohol use or drug use. You can sort of determine what's going on in the family unit. We know domestic violence and the stresses around that have great impacts around the rates of preterm delivery. So I think we're losing a window of opportunity. And later on in a couple slides, I'll talk about the importance now. Nationally, there's a big movement around preconception care, really working with women prior to them even thinking about getting pregnant, and then care in between pregnancies. We've not done a good job of supporting women in between the pregnancies, and what we know physiologically is that babies do better, mothers do better, if they have at least a 2-year period in between their pregnancies. Remember the 2-year apart Baby Smart campaign that we had a while back. So there's a big effort, and that's kind of, those are some of the solutions that, you know, I'm going to sort of address as we go on.
Okay, maybe we should just go ahead and go through it first then, and then have our questions afterward.
Okay.
And let the record show that Representative Gatto is joining us. Okay, go ahead, Stephanie.
Okay.
Try not to interrupt.
No, that's quite all right. I think your questions are helpful. The other point I want to make is that coverage has steadily for insurance steadily increased until about 2002, and then if you remember in 2003 we had a statutory passage of freezing the Medicaid rate at 175%, and then over time, of course, because there's no ability to modify that for cost of living changes, it's actually steadily, the eligibility level is steadily decreasing over time. And we're at about 164% of poverty at the present time. So low birth weight and preterm births, to some degree, Alaska's had some success in really reversing our trend that had existed when I first got into neonatal care in the early 80s. So we're a success in some degree where we our proportion of low birth weight, when you compare us to the nation, is much better than the nation. We haven't quite met the Healthy People goal. However, a proportion of preterm births and very low birth weight babies, so these would be babies that are less than 1,500 grams. So if you think of a pound of butter is 16 ounces, that's about 2.2 pounds. So these kids are half that amount, a half a pound of butter, if you were, or less. Our numbers of babies that are born very, very small is increasing. And this year, we've really noticed an upward trend, even with our proportion of low birth weight births, although not all of our data is analyzed for that. And so that's very disconcerting, because these kids are very expensive. We know that, on the whole, newborn hospital charges nationally run around $1,500 for a normal newborn birth. For a baby that spends a week in the newborn intensive care, you're looking at around $80,000. And so, you know, if we're thinking about cost effectiveness here, keeping babies out of the NICU is really a goal. I've been associated with the level 3 NICU at Providence for over 20 years, and the numbers are increasing of the number of small babies that are actually being admitted into the into that center, and they're smaller than they used to be. So they're going to spend many more days in there, which, and 75% of those kids eventually qualify for Medicaid. So it's a huge expense, I think, and plus then the kids are born with outcomes that are not as positive as we really would like them to be and have lifelong issues that many times Medicaid is responsible for helping to support. Birth defects is another issue that I would just like to call your attention to, and I think most of you, and Representative Wilson actually has a copy of the book that we sent to all of you. It's one of our health data books, and it would have just come in the mail here in the last week or so, and it's the first time that we've been able to publish 10 years worth of data regarding birth defects in our state. Collection of birth defect information is a mandatory reporting system. At the present time, it's funded through our Maternal Child Health Block Grant. And so all hospitals and provider groups who diagnose a child with a birth defect that's on our list in law are required to let us know about that. And then we go out and actually do chart reviews, especially around some of the birth defects that we have questions about. And so I think the things to point out here is our mortality, so the number of children who die because of birth defects. We actually look relatively good in comparison to the nation. However, we haven't met our healthy people goal. And our incidence of spina bifida and other neural tube defects. So these are defects of the spine.
No.
Yes, I'm
NTD,
sorry.
NTD, I'm sorry.
NTD is neural tube defect.
Okay, thank you. I just was
So these are defects of the spine. This is when the spinal cord is open instead of closed, and that would have happened during the developmental period in the first 1 to 8 weeks of during conception. And we know that one of the best ways to prevent those defects is to take a folic acid supplement, basically an extra dose of folic acid. Many of our vitamins have that, or you can take an extra dose of folic acid, or you can get it through your diet, but you have to be very rigorous about making sure you have enough. We looked at where our high rates are occurring, and they are in the interior and southwest regions. They're lowest in the northern and Gulf Coast regions. And as I mentioned, folic acid reduces the risk of neural tube defects affecting pregnancy by 50 to 75%. And this has really been quite a remarkable change over time. When we measure the knowledge of women knowing about folic acid, the knowledge by women that we've been able to survey, the number of women has actually increased from 63 to 81%. So approximately 5% of our babies, of the 10,000 plus babies born in the state, are born with at least one major congenital anomaly or birth defect. Most common are the cardiovascular defects. And so you can imagine these are very expensive defects. Most of these babies need to be flown outside for surgery. And many times can have lifelong sequelae as a result. The other defect that we have is genital urinary kinds of defects. So roughly 1 in 60 live births has a heart defect, and 1 in 150 live births have congenital genital urinary. Fetal alcohol syndrome. We continue to lead the nation in our prevalence of children born to with effects born to women who have been drinking in pregnancy. Approximately 126 children are born every year with fetal alcohol syndrome. what's interesting is there are lots of aspects, and of course we've had a program through the Division of Behavioral Health, and then we work in my section to analyze much of the data. FAS is also a reportable birth defect, and so we actually do 100% chart review on all children who are reported to us. But what's fascinating, I think, to me, and disheartening to some degree, is that when we surveyed the physicians, and the Division of Behavioral Health actually did this, responding to a survey, 36% of them, of the OBGYNs and 18% of family practice, said it was okay for women to drink in pregnancy. And so to me, I think, where have we gotten lost in this message here? Our message really now, and you hopefully have seen many of the really outstanding ads that are out in the media right now, is that abstinence from drinking in pregnancy, no amount of alcohol, is really considered to be safe. Our challenge, of course, is once women are screened, if we successfully screen them early in pregnancy, we really don't have enough beds available or treatment services for women who are pregnant, and particularly women who have small children who are pregnant. And so there's lots of good work happening there, but we don't seem to really have achieved in meeting the need for treatment. Other birth issues I think that we need to kind of think about is our post-neonatal mortality rate, and I know I'm throwing a lot of terms out, but what that means is the neonatal period is considered the first 30 days of life. So this would be after the 30th day of life up to the first year. And sadly, our post-neonatal mortality rate is 2.7 times greater than the Healthy People 2010 target, and it's 1.6 times that of the national rate. We know some of that is associated with our high incidence of SIDS, sudden infant death syndrome. And in the data that we looked at from 2001 to 2003, we were 4.3 times higher than the Healthy People 2010 target, and 1.5 times higher compared to the nation as a whole. We have significant health disparities that exist in this area. We know that infants born to mothers less than 20 years of age are significantly more likely to die within the first year of life, and that significance is almost 1.3 to 1.4 times greater in women less than 20 years of age. Infant mortality amongst Alaska Natives is twice that of adults. And this exists despite the fact that infant mortality for infants has steadily been decreasing, but the percentage of difference continues to be remarkable. For post-neonatal mortality, then after 30 days of life for natives, it has steadily increased and is 3.3 times higher than whites. We've done a lot of work around SIDS and around the Back to Sleep campaign, but this health disparity continues to really persist. And then finally, for my last sort of outcome slide, is on infant sleep position and co-sleeping. And you may have seen some of the public press, you know, that was out there around the American Academy of Pediatrics statement around, you know, it's never safe to sleep with your baby. We actually have an increasing number of women and families in our state who do report that they have their infants co-sleeping with them. And so when you look at behavioral changes, it's probably not going to work for us to say, no, this isn't going to work, because people are going to do that anyway. But what we've tried to do is really initiate a campaign around how to sleep safely with your baby. And so not only the Back to Sleep program, but really educating folks around not having fluffy blankets, not being on water beds, and never to sleep with your baby if you've ingested alcohol or some other substance. And so that's what we found, is that our prevalence of Alaska mothers in 2002 was nearly 2.5 times greater from 1991 with women co-sleeping. And in Alaska, when we've analyzed all of our death records, the association between co-sleeping and infant death was found only in cases where the adult was impaired by alcohol or drugs. So I think I like to move on to solutions and thinking about, you know, what can we do about some things. So I'm going to throw out more of some broader topics, and I think Representative Wilson's intention then was to sort of talk about some of these. Is that correct? So I think improving the access to preconception care and early prenatal care is really one of the foremost foundational kinds of things that I think we need to consider. And this has really been looked at heavily nationally. enhancing funding for providers for education, for education and prevention services. Healthcare providers also need assistance about what resources are available. They're focused on seeing patients in the office, not necessarily on doing care coordination. And having run physician practices before, they need to see a certain number of patients in order to make ends meet to pay their staff and heat and lights and those kinds of things. And so care coordination for high-risk women, having been a part of that structure for a long time, is very time-consuming. But it's really very much needed for high-risk pregnancies, especially looking at their social risk, what's happening with them physically in terms of diabetes, chronic health care problems, behavioral activities that put mothers and babies at risk. Enhanced fees for providers who do this in their office in support of maintaining a medical home concept would be one idea to really consider. So as opposed to having a case management model, considering enhancing a fee potentially, and this is done in some states where fees are enhanced slightly for physicians who offer case care coordination in their office. That keeps the family attached to that medical home, which really ultimately is what our goal is.
I think maybe at this point, when she's talking about solutions, if anyone has any questions, that we should go ahead and ask them. And I do want to point out that when we were in Denver, that was one of the things that they brought out, that improving access to mothers, both before they're pregnant, while they're pregnant, and after they're pregnant, made more difference than anything else. And we try to think that there's other things, that would make a difference, but they said those were the things that would make more difference, and which I was surprised that how important that is. Mm-hmm. So question, Stephanie.
Yes.
How much does a normal insurance company pay for those types of visits?
Well, the major provider groups, such as Aetna and Blue Cross, if I'm still current on my information, generally they will pay for a certain number of visits considered in a normal pregnancy, and then if a pregnancy is deemed to be high risk, then you get approval for additional visits. For some package plans, it's a set amount of money, and so I think sometimes then providers are motivated to keep more of that money at the later stages of pregnancy when potential pregnancy problems could exist, and pay less attention to sort of what's happening in the early parts of pregnancy.
Now, what is Medicaid?
Medicaid is on a per visit basis.
And they don't limit it at all?
I'm not the expert in that particular arena. I would really need to consult my Medicaid colleagues, but I think that it's probably, Director Fuller might know.
Do you know the answer to that, Jerry?
I don't know that level of detail off the tip of my tongue.
We could certainly find out, though.
Representative.
What about Native health care? A lot of Alaskans have access through Indian health care services. Do they cover prenatal or even prenatal care?
Oh, yeah, through the chair, Representative Gardner. Yes, they offer prenatal care, and they do a very, very nice job. For the last 3 years, they've actually had a high-risk maternal fetal doctor who is available to care for their highest-risk families. I think what's challenging for there's lots of going back and forth, I think, of our Native families. They come into a larger area and then they go back out. So tracking them and keeping them on task with appointments can be challenging. A lot of families want to deliver in their small villages, and so they because that's where the community is, and it's a birthing experience in a village is a really positive experience. And so sometimes I think the referral process into a sub-regional center perhaps doesn't happen as quickly, not for lack of recognition on the part of the healthcare provider, but just because it takes a lot more to get families in. What we've found in reviewing some of the data of the families or babies that have been transferred into the newborn intensive care unit is we could do a lot to work with our rural providers, both at the health aid level as well as mid-levels and physicians, to educate them about some of the high risk factors, such as blood pressure. More and more women with chronic health conditions who never would have perhaps gotten pregnant years ago are getting pregnant now, or even in their 20s they have issues around obesity, chronic hypertension, diabetes that exists prior to them getting pregnant in much greater numbers than we ever experienced 20 years ago. And unless those women are really stable, they run the risk of really affecting their pregnancy if their health condition is not optimal.
Representative Sisson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To that point, we have this amazing increase in obesity. You're talking about low birth weight, and how much study has there been on the tie of those two? Because one would expect that to go up as we lose, if we lose the battle on obesity, which I can't see why we would be able to turn it around unless we do something astoundingly different than what we're doing now.
Yeah, that's interesting. Through the chair, Representative Sisna, I don't know of any studies myself that are out there looking at the rate of obesity associated with low birth weight. Physiologically and anecdotally, I can share with you that some of the most obese patients had some of the smallest babies. And of course, despite the fact that you're increasing your blood supply when you're pregnant by 3 times, a lot of that is already diverted to a woman's own weight that she's carrying. And so there's not enough sometimes blood supply and nutrient value left to feed the baby. What's also very interesting is that most women who are very, very obese are not able to successfully deliver vaginally, and so have a higher rate of cesarean deliveries, which we also know is climbing in very significant proportions. These women also tend, because they end up with chronic high blood pressure, or pregnancy-induced hypertension is what we call it when you get it when you're pregnant. These women are at greater risk for diabetes and pregnancy-induced hypertension, and so their babies are delivered earlier. So then we have issues of smaller babies who don't have mature lungs who get very, very sick and are in the NICU for extraordinarily long periods of time. So obesity, from that perspective, has been looked at in terms of it complicating the delivery significantly. I am amazed by my own experience how high the BMIs are of women who are pregnant. It's pretty astounding, actually, and the chronic healthcare conditions that they come into their pregnancy with. So again, I think focusing on that time, that preconception time, and then time in between pregnancies to try to get, if women have gained 100 pounds in their pregnancy, which is not uncommon, to try to get that weight off before they have the next baby is just imperative.
Representative Gardner, you had a question?
She can follow up first.
You have a follow-up?
Talking about the high risk and obesity and that kind of thing, the thing that keeps striking me over and over again is talking about the incredible expense of children or babies that wind up hospitalized right at the point when that separation from mother physically and the bonding that's absolutely requisite to develop all of the social things that we expect people to be able to do, to certainly bond with people, but then to care, all of the things that are required to not have a lot of police and institutionalization. So it would seem to me that if we're going to focus on anything, it's bringing down hospitalization in with children, because we solve a whole big host of problems besides just physical. It's the mental health, it's all the, probably the ability to learn, all of that stuff I think goes with trying to reduce hospitalization.
Mm-hmm. Through the chair, Representative Sista, I think you are exactly right. Care in the newborn intensive care in the 26 years I've been involved in it has dramatically changed. In fact, the whole layout of newborn intensive care units has changed, and you may want to visit Providence at some point. It's common now to develop single room care where they actually have a bed in there for the parents with a bathroom, so parents can actually move in there and help care for the parents. I think the whole philosophy around a parent is a parent and nursing is nursing, and instead of parents being visitors, they're parents. And so, you know, NICUs have opened up, their parents are welcome 24 hours a day. There's a lot of accommodations that have attempted to be made, albeit you know, it takes a lot of remodeling and space to sort of do that type of care. But you are exactly correct in terms of children who are born not so much premature, but those that are left with long-term sequela, cerebral palsy or special health care needs or respiratory disorders are at twice the risk, actually more than twice the risk for child abuse and neglect over time. And it's very, very challenging, I think, for rural families to, when they have children in a small village or a rural community where that's where their livelihood is, to have a baby, you know, 1,500 to 2,000 miles away. It's very stressful for that family unit to try to maintain some sort of bonding and ties. And I think, children are just affected long-term, you know, can be affected long-term by that. So you're exactly right.
The chart on low birth weight and preterm birth, it's on page, I don't know, they're not numbered, but it shows that Alaska is actually doing better than the national average. And it struck me when you talked about women who are getting pregnant now who previously didn't, that if those numbers are also included in here, then we've done some very good things. We've made some significant progress, at least by these measures.
We have, although this data is 2003, and when we've looked at more recently our data from the vital stats, although we haven't been able to yet compare it with some other things, we have seen our rate is starting to steadily increase. And one of the, I'll get you another flyer on, you can just barely see a little bump on that. So our low birth rate has not increased as rapidly as it has in the nation elsewhere, but it is steadily increasing. One of the reasons why our proportion of low birth weights has decreased is the advent back in the early 80s of the newborn intensive care unit and the whole transport system. I don't know if you're familiar with transporting mothers and babies in from some of the rural hubs into a high-risk center and the development of inpatient units for high-risk mothers to actually stay in the hospital and have their pregnancies monitored. And the proportion of low birth weights is a direct result of that, where we were able to keep babies in those incubators, those natural incubators, to get them to grow to be bigger. However, we still have babies that are really sick. And what's interesting is that there's always been over 400, 380 to 400 deliveries or babies coming into the newborn intensive care at Providence, and about 150 going into Alaska Native Medical Center. And those numbers are steadily increasing as well. And the babies are smaller and sicker. So,
thank you.
Okay. Just a couple other comments I have for you then. Oops. I think one of the things I'd like to really stress around solutions is looking at smoking cessation. The data indicates that's probably one of the most important interventions that we can make for women. And how that's linked to early prenatal care is that in the early stages, women are very, no matter sort of what their social situation, I think every mother wants to have a healthy baby. And they tend to be very, very motivated to change their behavior. We're fortunate, and Director Fuller and his staff in healthcare services did a marvelous job in putting together a smoking cessation program. However, pregnant women tend to benefit from specific educators that are trained in working with pregnant women in smoking cessation because their issues are different. And so we don't really have enough cross-trained folks in throughout the state who really know how to work with women and successfully support them in their smoking cessation efforts. And of course, the patches and things like that cannot be used by pregnant women either. So there's a lot of self-talk and support that needs to happen in a very different fashion than someone who is able to use patches or Nicorette gum during those phases, because those are not approved for pregnant women. Folic acid education, I think greater emphasis needs to be placed on that. We do, my particular section gets a little bit of money, $1,500 a couple of years ago from Arch Dimes to do folic acid prevention education, and we do what we can to sort of distribute that out, but our funding for that has been relatively limited. Again, I think supporting the alcohol abstinence kinds of programs and some of the efforts that Representative Wayrock introduced last legislative session around FAS are things that can be considered a back-to-sleep program for SIDS prevention and good education around co-sleeping. We know, just one little data point you might be interested in, eliminating maternal smoking may lead to a 10% reduction in all infant deaths and a 12% reduction from perinatal conditions such as low birth weight, airway disease, and sudden infant death syndrome. So finally,
will you say that again?
Eliminating maternal smoking may lead to a 10% reduction in infant deaths and a 12% reduction from perinatal conditions that include things like low birth weight, respiratory disease, and sudden infant death syndrome.
So that would be a lot of savings right there if we could get people to stop smoking.
Yeah. Yeah, which feeds right into the talk around chronic disease that you'll get from my colleague in chronic disease, and then I think finally greater access to intraconception care, so that's care in between pregnancies to encourage the use of regular birth control and achieve birth spacing of 2 or more years. Women who qualify for the Denali Kid Care program for pregnancy have care, postpartum care, up to 8 weeks postpartum. Then their care ends, which means unless they have a permanent solution for birth control, they have no birth control after 60 days. And we do have a number of public health centers and community health centers that offer free or reduced birth control. But even birth control pills at a reduced amount are still fairly expensive. And so access to that, we know that...
How much are they nowadays?
If you were to pay retail, they're about $50 a month. Yeah, at a reduced sliding scale fee, anywhere from $6 to $8. But, you know, for a woman who might be on supported care, that's a lot of money to put out. And then, of course, many offer them for free. But we also know that women will take birth control pills, especially young women, for the first 3 months correctly, and after that period of time do not take them correctly. So a lot of support and education needs to happen around different means of contraception. Studies show that for every dollar spent in family planning... Oh, sorry.
Representative Sisson.
Thank you. You could maybe tell me, last year I thought it was when I was visiting public health offices in rural areas, they were having a real problem even getting a hold of birth control, let alone having the cost be affordable. Is that continuing? Is access a problem to even getting the medication or the, I don't know, it's medication, whatever, but it's means. Whatever it is, yeah. Out there?
Through the chair, Representative Sisna, there are some types of birth control that are harder to get than others, and through another project, we're really trying to work on access issues for that. But for example, you're sort of held hostage sometimes to the drug companies, even with our special ability to buy less expensive birth control pills through Ortho. They've just quadrupled the price, and so the volume in which you can buy, even at our reduced rate at the state level, has dramatically been affected by that. So one of the data points I was going to share with you is that for every dollar spent in family planning, three Medicaid dollars are saved for prenatal and newborn care. And that's been really quite well documented. So thinking about things about family planning waivers, expanding Medicaid or other forms of payment to women to have access to family planning services could really be considered very helpful.
Representative Godin.
Oh, thank you. I'm going to go back just a couple of questions. We were talking about low birth weight, mm-hmm. and saying that's on the increase.
It is.
And the question I have, what about high birth weight? Particularly, I'm looking at diabetic babies. Is that increasing or is that level?
Through the chair, Representative Gatto. Actually, baby sizes in terms of on the high end are not necessarily what we find with women who have diabetes are monitored very, very carefully, providing they get in for care. And the challenge is that as babies get bigger, they're not necessarily more healthy in a diabetic mother or in a woman who's obese. And so, as I shared earlier, what's happening is that many times these women are induced early or are delivered by cesarean delivery before the baby is actually fully term. We call them near-term infants. And March of Dimes in particular has been very, very concerned about that because it's heavily contributing to our numbers of babies that are coming into the newborn intensive care unit. And these babies tend to be very, very sick because they're strong, and so they try to breathe on their own, but their lungs are not mature. And so a whole series of other physiological changes happen that make them very, very sick and consequently very expensive. Babies who are born to women who are obese are actually can be smaller because the blood system supplying the mom and the baby is sort of diverted to supporting the mother's own weight. And so babies who are born to obese women tend to be around the 5 to 6 pound mark, but they're also delivered by cesarean delivery in higher proportions, which is a cost and potentially can cause long-term effects.
Just a follow-up. Folic acid is really cheap, really cheap. Is it valuable for, during gestation, there's no question. How about previous to gestation? And then secondly, is it any effect by males taking folic acid prior to conception?
Well, through the chair, Representative Gatto, I'll answer your first question around it is very inexpensive for the most part, depending upon where your own income is. It sometimes can be an additional expense, but we've really tried to work hard through WIC and some of our other services to make that available. Our push has been actually to encourage young women, even in their teens, to take a multivitamin that has 400 micrograms of folic acid. And so through just family planning and reproductive health centers and pediatric services, there's a big push to do that. Access sometimes can be hard to multivitamins, and if you look at the prices in rural villages for multivitamins, just like for everything, it's pretty expensive. In terms of men taking folic acid, we also know that there are a lot of studies going on around the importance of folic acid and actually its effects on heart disease, its positive effects for prevention of heart disease and many other, some forms of cancer. And so that's why I think in most multivitamins, be it one a day for men or one a day for women, you'll actually find larger proportions of folic acid in the multivitamins. And of course, it's been added to all of our cereals and bread and grain products as well. However, you have to drink the milk. If you have it in your cereal, you got to drink the milk because the folic acid dissolves in the milk. So get your kids to drink their milk.
And it's unused otherwise?
Yeah. Well, you throw your milk out and your folic acid is sitting in the bottom of your bowl. So it's a water-soluble vitamin.
I see.
Yeah, I just wanted to go back again to the we're talking about the Planned Parenthood
reproductive segment, health.
Reproductive health. I was just seeing an ad on the TV a month ago about the new long-term implant.
Mm-hmm.
And is that in use in Alaska? Are we looking at doing that instead of having this every day taking a pill kind of thing? And is that available through the Native Health Service as well?
Through the chair, Representative Seaton, it's just been FDA approved, and so its availability yet is not out there. I think we'll need to evaluate it from a cost standpoint. Through an agreement that we have with the Division of Public Health and looking at teen and out of wedlock pregnancy, we had dollars provided to help purchase contraceptives that were other avenues besides birth control pills. And there are two very good IUDs that are out on the market available for women in their early 20s. One is good for 10 years, one is good for 5 years. There's also a new form birth control called Nuva Ring, and it's a vaginal ring that's placed and is quite popular as well. So we'll have to kind of see from a cost-benefit analysis. Plus, it would take an advanced nurse practitioner to insert that, or mid-level of some sort. Not all health centers have regular availability of those services. But I think, depending upon the cost, we'll certainly look at something like that, doing the training.
Follow-up.
Thank you. Can you make sure you provide that information back to us?
Sure.
As far as the cost effectiveness and not only the cost effectiveness as far as the direct cost, but also the failure rate of people taking pills. I mean, your comment was that for the first 2 or 3 months after pregnancy they do, and then they slip, and I can well understand. And so those failure rates would be something I would want to see as they analyzed in the cost effectiveness, as well as just, if you take the pills correctly for a long time, and if you take the implant, you know, what is that cost? But also looking at the cost of the failure to maintain the, taking the pills correctly.
Okay.
And I have a question. The Nora plant that mm-hmm. they used to use, there was a lot of problems with that. And this other one that Representative Seaton was talking about, I assume that they've done all kinds of research and this is much better.
Nora plant, if you remember, had five implants that were placed, and although women who got them really liked them or really hated them, they were terrible to try to take out if women weren't happy with them or when at the end of 5 years, and there were complications with skin irritation and that sort of thing. You know, it's just been approved. We don't have any experience. I think I'd be happy to provide that data with you, although it'll take some time till we have some experience on its usage and at least 9 months, because that's how long it takes for gestation to take place. But it certainly will be something that we'll be looking at, and I'd be happy to provide that data for you, Representative.
Because I worked in a clinic in 93, and we were putting a lot of those in.
Yeah.
And but a lot of them would come back, and they didn't like them. They wanted them out, and it was very difficult. And so I'll be anxious to hear how that works.
Yeah, Representative Wilson. It'll be interesting. Depo-Provera, which is a shot that's given, was very, very popular for women because it was once every 3 to 6 months, and you know, if you didn't mind shots, it worked okay. But what we found over long term is that it actually robs young women of their calcium stores and sets them up for osteoporosis long term. So you know, sometimes it takes time. What might appear to be effective over time, then as the data is looked at, you have to really be careful. And so, in fact, Depo-Provera is used a little bit more conservatively and generally only for a maximum of 2 years in young women in order to help them, before they get to their 20s, try to restore some of their bone calcium deposits so that they don't have problems on the other end of their life spectrum. So,
and it's pretty hard for them to remember 3 months when they're supposed to come back in too. That
yeah.
was a difficult.
There's a whole reminder process. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. Proceed.
So other questions at all? I think that's
Okay.
Reverend Gatto?
Yeah. I just have another question on co-sleeping.
Yes.
It seems like infant beds have gotten so cushy that the kids are almost in space. There is no external stimulation, and I've always felt it was pretty natural to co-sleep, and all of that external movement, pushing, shoving, is probably helpful.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a study that indicates that, you know, of course you can be drunk and roll over, and I mean, there are instances, and we can identify them, but there are many other instances where kids die in their nice little baskets, too.
That's great. Through the chair, Representative Gatto, there's actually a lot of good research out there that shows the positive side of co-sleeping, especially when it comes to breastfeeding,
sure.
Breastfeeding cessation. And there's one gentleman that we actually had come up and lecture quite a number of years ago at a conference who found that probably the incidence of SIDS was reduced because of the when he looked at infant breathing and maternal breathing, they tended to mirror each other. When he did sleep studies, it was pretty fascinating. And right. So it actually, you know, his theory was that this perhaps prevented SIDS from occurring. Our statement that came out in an Epi Bulletin recently was that in Alaska, we were not necessarily going to take the stand that the American Academy of Pediatrics had stated, which was, you know, no co-sleeping and under any circumstances. We really felt a much more balanced approach, especially when we look at the number of women who report on our PRAM survey. They're increasing dramatically in terms of co-sleeping. Family beds are much more socially acceptable than they were maybe when we were growing up. But we want to make them safe. And so we do a lot of education around, you know, please don't put babies on water beds. And those have sort of gone out of style, but there are some people that still have them. The down blankets is probably the biggest issue, especially in our colder climates. Pillows around them. Actually, the market has responded to co-sleeping. Interestingly, if you ever go down the baby aisle at Walmart, they're actually little beds that will slide in under your mattress, and so you have this sort of little bed that's, that can be placed on either side of your bed that slides in.
Wow.
So it's sort of a nice flat surface, real close to mom, and lots of times that's what's being recommended. Babies in hammocks, which is common in some of our rural communities, we're really trying to discourage because of head placement. And then, you know, really just teaching parents that if you're going to drink or use drugs, you know, put your baby in their own bed during that period of time. So we're not discouraging co-sleeping for the reasons that you've expressed.
Are you encouraging it or neutral?
We're neutral. Mm-hmm. So I think the only couple of things I just want to mention to you, you may be familiar with the fact that we have a maternal infant morbidity and mortality review committee, which most states who are really concerned about kids have, and we've had one for a long, long time. We reviewed 10 years worth of data, and we found that 28% of the deaths that occurred of mothers. So we do have pregnancy-associated deaths, and these are deaths that would occur after the time of delivery up to a year after delivery. 28% of those, in over a 10-year period, alcohol was a contributing factor. And 23% of them had to do with socioeconomic factors, and inappropriate medical care contributed to 10%. So these are women who have died up to a year after having delivered a baby. What we did find, though, just to summarize, is 60 to 77% of those deaths for women are considered preventable. And some of the topics under better patient education or preventable would have been better patient education, more aggressive tertiary referral. So if women are sick out in a rural community, getting them into a tertiary facility would have saved their life. Improvements in medical management.
Representative Gardner.
Excuse me, can we go back just a second? What percentage were due to medical factors?
10%.
So you said 20% had alcohol factors?
28%.
28%, 23% socioeconomic, and 10% medical factors. So my question is, the medical factors, are they associated with the postpartum condition or unrelated, or do we know?
I actually reviewed this data for my master's thesis. Some of it was associated with lack of recognition around high blood pressure. You tend to, when you've had a baby, you come back 6 weeks postpartum if you've delivered vaginally, or 8 weeks if you've had a cesarean delivery, sometimes a little sooner than that. Sometimes women will have high blood pressure that climbs after they've delivered, and it's not recognized. So that was the case in a couple of those deaths. Drug use was a high contributing factor. So it has to do more around the chronic conditions that perhaps weren't well controlled after they delivered.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Alcohol treatment and drug abuse treatment were also indicated. Mental health counseling. And I haven't mentioned, although we talked, as Representative Wilson knows, at our meeting in Denver, we talked a lot about postpartum depression and the number of women who continue to, an increasing number of women who are remarking about acknowledging the fact that they have experienced postpartum depression, and then domestic violence, and having greater availability of shelters and safety management plans for women who are experiencing domestic violence. A number of these women died by their partners.
Golly. So now we know that domestic violence increases when they're pregnant. Does that carry through to after they're pregnant?
Representative Wilson, yes, it does. We know, and Linda Chamberlain's actually sort of the expert in this area, but I can share with you that from what I have learned from her is domestic violence does continue to escalate because the partner is sometimes not achieving the level of attention because the baby is sort of the focus and level of attention. And so there can be other issues associated with that. And there's frustration. It's hard to have a new baby at home. It's tense and people are tired. Yeah. And I mean, they can be lovely, but they're a lot of work. And so that can really disrupt the family unit as well.
Okay.
So I'm open for other discussion, or I can...
I passed the book around, Representative Sisson. Would you go ahead and the book right there. I take two places in it just to look because I thought it was very, very interesting. When I went through it, it was shocking to me that by far where the majority of the problems were, if there were disabilities in children that were born, and by far almost double, they were in, and I hope I'm not putting too much into this more than, but it looked like it was in the northern areas, in the southwest areas,
that's
and that's
correct.
Probably where more of the natives are.
Yeah.
And so I was really surprised at how, what a big difference that was. And so, you know, so I think that's one of the areas that I think we really need to zero in on somehow. And but I would imagine that'll be a little bit touchy because they get their health care from free. And so I don't know for sure how do we go. Actually, I was sitting on the plane with, let me think now what his name is. Ken Brewer from Search, and he asked me to, I told him about the meeting today, and he was very interested, and he wanted us to put him on the list for future meetings, but he couldn't come to this one. But so I think that there can be education that we work on that will be helpful. And so what I'd really like now, and also members of the committee that went to Denver, please, just because you're not up here, in fact, some of you can come up and sit, you know, but what this is now, I want it to be a real work committee right now and see what things we can do to save money in Alaska on our health care and in our on our HES budget, because it keeps growing tremendously.
Representative Wilson, this is Jerry Fuller, the Medicaid director, and I'd like to make a couple of comments, if I could. There's been a couple of references through the discussion this morning about Alaska Natives receiving their health care free, and yes, technically that's correct. They don't have to pay for it to the tribal clinics. But the Indian Health Service grant to the Alaska Tribal Health Corporations isn't all that encompassing. At a national level, it's estimated that it funds about 57% of the need. So while they do, the tribal corporations do get many millions of dollars from the IHS each year, it's not nearly sufficient to provide all of the services that would be available, say, to you and I under our private insurance plan. For instance, behavioral health, substance abuse, they have very inadequate systems, I'll put it that way, for meeting the need of their membership. And because of that, they are required, forced to look to Medicaid as a first payer to be able to provide some of those services. So while there's been reference to free care for these folks, the care system isn't funded adequately to begin to meet all of their needs. And then the second aspect, boy, it just escaped me, but it'll come back later.
Yeah, okay, thank you very much, Jerry, because that I didn't realize that, and I don't know.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
You know, because I do know that they take the insurance first, they take Medicaid first, and before they will take their own, and I didn't realize that was the reason why. Representative Seaton.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I had a question on the aspect that we've been talking here today about prenatal care and issues surrounding that. Is that one of those areas where the Native Health Service does not provide adequate funding for services? I mean, I can understand in some places there aren't services available. I'm not meaning that, but I'm meaning where there are services available, is that, are the issues surrounding prenatal and care, is that one of those areas that isn't covered by Indian Health Service?
This is Jerry Fuller. It's hard to say. I believe that the tribal corporations expend their federal funds to support prenatal care birthing services, but you know, you have multiple tribal corporations, and so their ability to maybe fully address the issues would vary between the corporations. Perhaps South Central Foundation in the Anchorage area is well established, but then some of the smaller, more rural areas, while they may have funding, they may not be able to get the physician capacity or nursing capacity that they need. So it's probably fairly well funded and adequate, but I wouldn't be surprised that there are deficiencies in some areas, not necessarily due to funding, but due to other factors.
And I'm thinking right now that when I lived in Tok and worked in the clinic there was, and we had five villages that would come into the clinic at various times, but they all had health aides, and in the same building that the clinic was, there was a PA who was in charge of those five health clinics. And so to get an outreach where the health aides in the clinics, in those village clinics, that they would know the questions to ask, or that you know, they could get the information from someone that was pregnant, that, you know, to fill out the forms and things like that. Maybe there's training that needs to be done, but there's some things that we could do. It would take a little bit of expense to get out to those areas to do the training, but it seems to me that it would be well worth doing some of that. Jerry, do you know what the cost to the state is for just pregnancy care, prenatal and postnatal? Do you know what that amount is?
Unfortunately, not off the top of my head, but I can find out and email it after this meeting.
Okay. Commissioner Carling, why don't you?
I have actually, through the wonders of BlackBerry, what an individual woman would get in terms of services paid by Medicaid.
Madam Chair, why don't you come on up and either come up there or else come right up here, and then you'll be in front of the microphone. And Pat, do you have information that you were going to give too, if you do?
Yeah.
Well, why don't you just come on up so that you're in front of the microphone?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So what I've learned from Dwayne Peoples, who's our healthcare services director, is that per visit prenatally, Medicaid will pay $77.61 for a delivery, which, remember that Stephanie said a normal delivery is $2,500, if I remember correctly. Medicaid will pay $1,207, and per delivery post-care, $2,428. So as you can see, one of our issues is, even though we may have Medicaid funding where a woman does not have to pay for her prenatal care, we still have issues with how reimbursement happens related to Medicaid. So that's another thing for us to look at, as we're looking at rate setting and all the pieces and parts that go into funding the healthcare system. Medicaid doesn't fund it 100%.
Does anyone know what our budget for that area is in the state?
We can get that for you, Madam Chair.
I think it would be nice to know that, so that we can, as we proceed from one year to the next, if we're going to be doing some things that will hopefully make a difference, then we need to know what it is now and then watch it, because the cost is so huge in this area, and especially when you look at down the line when there are different birth disabilities and things like that. I think that if there are things that we can do that are really big-time prevention things, we need to start doing that, because if for every dollar it's spent, we save three, that's pretty awesome, really. So
the challenge is in demonstrating it.
Yeah, there is going to be some challenges in this, but that's what I'd like us to do. Let's come up with some things that we think we do. And Pat, why don't you come up? And Carlene Jackson was the one, was just speaking, and this is Pat Carr. And Pat, you had some comments.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. I wanted to make a couple of comments about some changes that we've seen in the state within the last five or six years related to expansion of the Community Health Center program. And I thought that it might be a helpful perspective to add at this point, and perhaps Stephanie may have, or the commissioner may have, a couple of extra comment, additional comments about this. Over the past 5 years, we have increased the number of federally funded community health centers in the state from Anchorage Neighborhood Health Center and Interior Neighborhood Health Center. Those two, 6 years ago, maybe 7 years now, were the only two health centers in the state that received federal funds from the federally funded community health center program. Since that time, we now have over 24 organizations, including those 23 organizations, including those two, that receive federal health center money. These grants usually are at least $650,000 a year. Many of the health centers receive more funding than that. Under this program, there is the definition of a more comprehensive range of care. An interesting note here with the previous lines of discussion are that the community health centers, about half of the 23 organizations, are also tribally managed organizations. What we've seen as a result of this is a partnership between the more tribal delivered services and traditionally non-tribal. We were one of the first states in the country to have this kind of partnership across our systems. There was one health center in Idaho that had developed this type of partnership. It's beginning to expand a bit across the country. I think this is a piece that we might want the committee and the project may want to look at a bit more, is what is happening as a result of this partnership. Even though there are 24 funded organizations, this funding disseminates to, depends on how you count, between 75 and 100 of our health centers. With the federally funded increase of federally funded health center monies, we have not seen a few new health centers, but most of them are health centers that have been around for a number of years, and we've brought up the capacity. Certainly the impact on, you know, can we get the adequate staffing to support them? You know, how is this helping sustain over time? But I certainly think would encourage us to look at this a bit, and I think later on when we have our health care discussion a bit more, I can certainly help us provide some more information. I don't know if Stephanie might have some additional information, because what I can't answer for you today is how many of these either had or already providing prenatal care, and now with these expanded resources, how many are able to bring that level of care up. But I think it is interesting that we're not exactly going in the right direction in some of our trends here.
Yeah, Representative Gardner.
Thank you. It seems like such an obvious thing to do, to partner with existing tribally managed organizations. And stuff. It's one of those ideas that makes you wonder, why didn't we do that from the outset, or why have we not always done it? Is there a downside to it? Are there problems or complications or impediments or arguments against doing that?
One of the requirements of the community health center program is that there has to be a community board. There are some, the tribal organizations do not have to follow that because of their own, it isn't required for the tribal organizations. There have been, in a few cases, some situations arise where there are perceived competitions in the community, and we have been working closely with them within the communities to make those decisions about what type of care the communities want to provide and through which organizational structures. The provision of care is close to where people are located has been a theme that we have been monitoring for a while. And I would say that through this program, we have been able to provide more care in the local communities. I'm not sure that's a very adequate answer, but I'm hard-pressed right off the top to think of a high number of negative reasons for doing this or not doing it. I mean, I think we seem to be doing fairly well in this regard.
Representative Sisson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I've had this discussion with various people in rural areas, and I think one of the huge concerns, and we've seen that, we've seen when we make our changes here in state government, for instance, and we're supposed to make funds available, we're supposed to do this or that or the other thing, we'll sometimes not come through with our side of it, or we'll make arbitrary decisions about what will be and what won't be in the community, and the community feels that they have a very strong idea of what ought to be in that community, and I think when they are left to their own devices in terms of survival a lot of times, and we come in and make decisions for them in a very important area, and then are not consistent in those decisions, right, there's good reason to kind of want to hold at least that really heavy management side at bay if you possibly can. I think I'd want to feel that way if I were in the middle of nowhere and I had somebody from far away deciding how I was going to spend my money and how I was going to do it, even though it didn't follow my desires. Mm-hmm.
Well, and from my experience, now this was in like 93 to 97, so I'm sure things have changed since then. But at that time, it was difficult even to find a health aide who would want to go to the clinic and be responsible, you know, 5 and sometimes 7 days a week if something came up. That person was the only one, and it was difficult to find someone that would do that, and they would never get a break, because on the weekends maybe somebody would need something, and so they would always go to this person, whether it was a man or a woman, they were only manned with one person usually, and sometimes more than that, but it's not easy to find someone that will live in the community, so they tried to get someone that was from the community, and then they had to go out and get training and things like that, and on just the basic things. But the responsibility is so great, and they would, you know, have a hard time continuing because it was nonstop. It wasn't like, okay, you come on the right time, and when the clinic is open, they were always, people didn't understand always why they couldn't just do it when I was, when it's convenient for me. And so sometimes it would be early in the morning, sometimes it'd be on the weekend. And so there's other aspects of this to think about, because you have to man it from within the community, and that's not always easy. Mm-hmm. So, Commissioner?
Madam Chair, to add to what Representative Sisna said, as we've worked on building our tribal partnerships over the last 3 years, part of what we found is we've had to start with developing a trusting relationship. And as you've mentioned, then it takes time to get the bureaucratic pieces in place, and we do what are called continuing care agreements and have to sit down and have several staff members on the tribal partner side as well as on the state side work together to work out all the pieces. So it is not an easy thing to happen, even though it is, as Representative Gardner said, such a logical thing to have happen. But the good news is we're making progress.
Yep.
Madam Chair, I was just going to go back to some of what Pat was talking about. I think the an avenue for delivery of prenatal care locally, using the quality, the community health centers and federally qualified health centers, is a terrific area to really focus some attention on. My more of my newfound relationships with those folks have I found providers to be very interested in providing care. Right now, we've kind of focused on discussions with them around family planning, but again, many times it's information, and it's knowledge of resources, and it's also their own training. Most of them are generalists. They may have touched on prenatal care sometime during their training, but haven't necessarily experienced that. They do a remarkable job and have a wide population range that they need to sort of focus their attention on. And of course, heavy users of many of the community health centers tend to be those with chronic health issues. And so I think appropriately, that's where a lot of their attention has been focused on. But I think one of the things that we can do in our section is to look at kind of developing a needs assessment of what needs for education, supplies, information, teaching kits, you know, will be helpful for them to be able to feel better, feel more capable of caring for early prenatal providing care for early prenatal and in between pregnancy interception care. And that might be an option to really consider as a task.
I wonder if they could even do, and I even hate to mention this because schools have so much on their plate already, but it would be kind of nice to be able to have just good health days or something, and then someone could come in and, or, you know, put it into the curriculum or something. But there again, you know, the schools are really, they do so much more now than teach school, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. and they're saying, you know, they're, you know, some schools are lucky enough to have school nurses, and but in Alaska, that is very not in the smaller schools, definitely as a rule. And if they could have some kind of a class that they took or something that would kind of just go over some of these basic things for girls. I mean, how often do we hear that teenage girls should take folic acid, you know, or that they should take vitamins, you know, just simple things like that. That's not kind of out there, or maybe it is, but I have not heard it anyway. Mm-hmm. And so, go ahead, Zeb.
Madam Chair, most of the school districts have a health curriculum that's required both in the grade school, junior high, and high school years. And depending upon the level of comfort on the part of the health educator, that might be their science teacher, it might be the school nurse, it might be a village health aide, some of that information is covered. We actually, as part of our project with the Division of Public Assistance, we're actually gathering materials available for some targeted communities to make sort of a wide range of health information available for them. And we'll be measuring sort of the effectiveness of that over time. But I think the most schools probably try to approach the topic, whether or not they, depending upon the level of comfort and competency of the instructor, really depends upon what topics are really going to be covered and if it fits into their school day.
Right. Commissioner, did you have a question? Representative Godwin.
Just for the record, Mat-Su does have school nurses in each school, mm-hmm. but the word school nurse, they're actually adjunct teachers. When it comes to personal safety, they separate the boys from the girls, and they do each grade all the way up the line. They have the classes for the teachers. Mm-hmm. So the school nurses are an important part of the curriculum. With regard to finding time in the day, boy, I'm with you on this. I don't know what we're going to do. Every time we add, whether it's an Alaska history program or a health program or something else, I keep thinking, unless we're going to keep people after the school day or do it in summer school, I don't know. You have to give something up every time you add something. And the question is, would you like a health curriculum? What do you want to delete? Mm-hmm. And I don't want to delete anything. Mm-hmm. Well, it doesn't fit. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got a 5-pound bag, and you've got 6 pounds of stuff. Mm-hmm. What are you, it's going to burst. Something's going to fall out. You have to tell me why. That's the issue that the schools are facing, is where to put it. Mm-hmm. We're feeding the kids, and we're feeding them more and more, not just breakfast anymore or just lunch anymore. My wife's a school nurse, and she keeps buying these boxes of treats. And they come in, they're having a little dish of cereal or so, and I said, what's Mom and Dad think about this? Do they feel guilty that the kids come in hungry, that they come in poorly dressed, that they come in tired? And the school nurses are essentially becoming adjunct mothers to a great many kids, and I think if we can get to the problem, it's the working mom and dad who say, I've got to leave the house at 7:30. If my kid can be fed in school, that's just fine. Off they go, because it's a nifty perk that the schools are providing. And I think I used to object to this, but I feel we have to, because if they're not fed, they're not fed. It doesn't matter who you point the finger at. They're not fed, and I don't want to point it at the kids. So I'm pointing it and saying, okay, feed them. Just bring them in early if you can, or something like that. All this myriad of problems with regard to health issues in the school, that's where we deal with them, whether it's, you know, places that you're not allowed to touch, or whether it's nutrition, or whether it's folic acid, or whether it's films. Right. You're right. Dental care, do we use additives to the drinking water? You know, who? Golly, it's a lot. Can we? What can we do? I guess that's the question. What can we do here? Do we make legislation mandating we don't do something, or we do something, or we stay out of it? I don't know.
Representative. Thank you. This is something I've been really concerned about in my area, and one of the ways that I've been working on it, because I think it's the only way that you can work on it, and that is we could we could, at the state level, develop maybe curriculum modules or that kind of thing, but then try to help people understand the only way you're going to affect the schools is to get involved with the curricula committees in the school district, because they're the ones who, and you know, the material that goes in practically every subject can actually be phrased in a way that affects the learning, the specific learning that's done, but aimed at that skill level or that type of skill. And the curricula committee is the one that does that, that lays out that that material that actually is taught. And an English class can be a great way to learn about health, but you need to develop the materials for the classes that has that in it. And we can do that at the state level, and then we can maybe even do trainings for people in communities that are working on curricula.
But every single school district has their own curriculum.
Absolutely.
You know? And you would have to somehow get with the school board and find out what their wishes are, and developing the curriculum is very, very, very involved. And you know, when on the curriculum committees, when a school decides to change their curriculum, it takes years for them to go through that and make those changes and things like that. So, but that is a definite. Commissioner, you had a comment?
Just one other comment. As we go through the series of looking at the different pieces and parts that we have scheduled out, you'll find that geographically, similar to what Stephanie's reported, Northwest Alaska and Interior Alaska have higher incidence, for example, of substance abuse, mental health issues, suicide. So one thought to keep in mind is, are there specific school districts that we could target with a promoting health curricula package of some kind around multiple issues?
Mm-hmm. And
thank you, Madam Chair. And of course, the thing is, number one, I joined my school district's curriculum committee just based on that whole concern. So it's the kind of thing that people don't even think of that as something they could do. So just making that kind of information of how do the systems work and how do you get involved in it. My aide Cindy Folsom, as a school counselor, wrote a huge amount of the curricula for the Fairbanks North Star Borough, or yeah, I don't remember the school district's name, but she did a lot, and based on having the materials at hand, it's a matter of just getting information to people and identifying the people who maybe could be involved, making sure people know how the system works.
And I think it's, I can't imagine what it would be like just to have one school. Because like, for instance, I've got six schools, and some legislators have many more than that. And so it's really not easy to have the time to do all of this type of thing, but we're talking. I want to make sure that we have notes so that, because what we'll do by the time we get done with this series of meetings, we'll be able to pull things together and see, okay, what areas of the state need the most help, what can we do, there were several. We have a whole list, and for those of you, I'll get the information to you that weren't at the other meetings. But we had several things that can be done that would be, it would take time to work on them, but PSAs, you know, those are free to do, but it takes a little time to get it pulled together and what you're going to say and everything. Maybe using faith-based initiatives in certain areas, that there can be volunteers in an area that will go in and train, but that would be an expense, because that would mean the department would have to train them before we have them go out, and so there's things that can be done that eventually won't cost as much, but that is going to cost a bit for us to pull together and figure out what we're going to do and things like that. So this is kind of what we're looking at, and this has taken an hour and a half, And so we might have to really think about expanding some of our time to more than 2 hours on some of these meetings. But we really need to take notes and see what we think would make a difference and what would we think make the biggest difference as we go through the subjects each time. And so does anybody else have any other comments or any suggestions at this time? Representative Seaton.
I had a couple questions back. One of the statements was that Denali Kid Care is really only 164% of poverty now instead of 175. And I was wondering, isn't the poverty rate, federal poverty rate, isn't that inflation indexed? And if it is, and we're paying 175% of poverty rate, how does that not translate?
The legislature actually made that determination probably 3 years ago, maybe? Mm-hmm.
2003. Yeah.
2003.
I understand that we made the call for 175%, but the statement was that is now 164% because of inflation. Mm-hmm. But my understanding was that poverty rate is itself changed at the federal level, depending on inflation.
I don't know.
And if that's the case, then 175% of the poverty rate is 175% of the poverty rate, because the poverty rate increases with inflation.
But ours
is 175% of that rate, which changes with inflation. So 175% of a rate that changes is going to be 175% of the poverty rate.
Commissioner? Yeah.
And I could be wrong, and Jerry may be able to correct me, but I believe in our legislation we put in the dollar amount of what was 175% of poverty at that time.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so the dollar amount doesn't change. Yeah. Although if we'd put 175% of poverty in, you're right, that would have been inflation factored. But I believe it was a dollar amount.
Okay, and maybe Jerry can let us know if that.
Jerry, is that correct?
Yeah, I think that's exactly correct. However, it's put in the statute, it did away with the inflation factor and froze the income level at a certain amount. So there's no longer an inflation factor within the Denali Kid Care program.
And if I remember at the time, it was growing so much that we were having a hard time of, it was a way of controlling costs during those years, and some legislators haven't experienced that, but it was during those years when we had to make cuts.
Right.
And so some legislators haven't experienced that frustration, and just because the price of oil has been up. So that's kind of where we're at right now, and we had to deal with that at that time. And if the price of oil wasn't up, we would still be dealing with it. So we have got to make sure, and that was one of the things that this conference in Denver really stressed, is that what you do, you want to make sure it's sustainable. And there's no guarantees at this time where we're going to be at and how we're going to be able to do these things. And so that was why, at that time, that was done. And I don't think at this point in time we dare change that, and maybe we'll find out with these things that would be saving enough in the long run that we should. But because of that, it's much worse to give somebody something and then take it away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have to be careful what we do to make sure it's sustainable, because we don't have a budget that is the same every year. You know, it keeps moving around and everything. So, Commissioner?
And I have to say this, I say this every meeting, I know, but the other thing we have to remember is the FMAP rate is only held harmless through 08, and so we're going to have a huge hit in the amount of the percent of Medicaid that we have to pony up from general funds that will also impact all the great things that we want to do. So we have to keep that in mind.
Yeah. So, I understand where you're coming from, and that's where we were coming from at the time. And so we've just touched on one item here today, and we want to all fix this and make it better, because we can save money by doing this. But we're going to find that every single subject we hit, it's going to be the same thing. So as we move along, keep it in mind, and we'll all have probably our favorite things, what we want to make sure happens. But I think we need to be very careful, and I really appreciate how much discussion has taken place today, and how much, obviously, I mean, it's pretty obvious to me that the more we can do up front with the prevention, my goodness, we save a lot at the other end.
This is Jerry Fuller, and I'd just like to comment upon that, that, you know, using healthcare dollars wisely, whatever that title was, you know, you've seen the studies, you agree with them or not, that if you invest a buck doing this, you'll save $5 later on. And that's all within the healthcare system. But in terms of overall savings, don't forget that certain investments early on may also decrease your juvenile justice or adult corrections budget later on, and can also impact the educational budget. If there's three fewer children with fetal alcohol syndrome, you've just saved thousands of dollars in your special education program. So it's not just health care savings that we should be thinking about, but what investment can we make that would cut across these state programs and potentially save the most money across the whole system?
Thank you. Thank you, Jerry. And another thing, tomorrow they're releasing the Blue Ribbon Committee on Early Childhood Development. That study has been going on for about 2 years now, and they're coming out with their recommendations tomorrow. So I'm anxious to see what they have to say, too. Representative Gardner.
I think Mr. Fuller hit the nail on the head, and I think it goes to something we talked about in this committee 2 years ago, that we would look at everything with a filter of alcohol to say, what does alcohol cost us? And it doesn't matter what we talk about here. It's kind of the old saying, if you really listen to your heart, you know the answers. And I think we all know the answers. If we get a handle on alcohol use in this community, we can talk about maternal child health. We can talk about saving money across the spectrum, education, health care, criminal justice, social needs. We all know that in this room. And if we simply focused on treatment beds, on services for people who are using, on prevention, that's really what we have to do. So,
and I, you know,
we don't need any more meetings. We just have to do that.
But you know what? We know that. We know that, but not always does the general, these are open to the public. And
we all know it.
Yeah. And we need to have data, because I want to be able to come forth as a HESC committee with weight behind what we suggest, with that we have actually gone the mile and done the research and checked things out, and now so that next year when we have our HESC budget and we have those deliberations, it is so frustrating at that time, we will be able to say we have spent a lot of time, a lot of effort, and money. 10 people from this state went to that conference in Denver. And we may decide exactly that. But if we just say it without going through the research, we won't have what we need to back up what we say in that committee. And that's why I feel like we need to go through what we do right now, and it will affect every aspect of our government in every way in the long run. But, you know, we still have the results of what's happening now, and even if we put in a lot of these things, we still have all this, and so it's going to take a while before we see a savings. I mean, it's going to take a long while, I think, because it takes, you know. So anyway, I appreciate everybody that's here. Can someone tell me what our next meeting subject is?
Madam Chair, I believe it's behavioral health, which will get at our alcohol issues, our substance abuse, mental health, and also the Office of Faith-Based and Community Initiatives, if you still want to have two topics in one meeting.
Okay, and I think we'll have to probably expand the meeting time a little bit in order to do that, but I think that would be better to do than try to fit more meetings in.
I think you're right.
Yeah. Representative Guardian.
It was Seaton.
Oh, Representative Seaton.
Yeah.
Seaton.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Probably a subject for the next meeting, but I passed out a handout here. This is from a nurse that I've known for 20 years, was in Homer and then has been at API for the last 4 years. And, you know, it's a real problem here. I mean, at API, she just resigned because she felt that continuing to practice nursing at API jeopardized her license. I mean, so we are talking about critical aspects. And this is not somebody who's, I mean, I've known her for a long time. A great nurse, really hung in there for a long time. They're looking at, her analysis is that if something doesn't change soon, that there's going to be mass resignations and we're not going to be able to find anybody to go back there. But that there's going to be lots of resignations that are simply waiting to see if there will be a change in the way it's administered and the way the staffing levels are. And I passed out to the department as well this email. As she says at the last, she's now resigned. She doesn't plan to go back and work for the state again, so she feels that she can go ahead and let us know this information. But I think it's critical that we look at this situation, and so I wanted everybody to, everybody hasn't had a chance to read it, but I hope everybody will take a look at that and contact other people that they may know, and hopefully the department will have somebody specifically here addressing this issue, because I know that on the last time we tried to do a shotgun approach of looking at nursing involuntary overtime, it turned out to be, you know,
API
among all, it turned out to be an API issue. Mm-hmm. And we're trying to address it with a shotgun and put reporting requirements on a lot of people that it wasn't. So we're going to have a lot more effects than we needed. And now I think with this, as well as the testimony that we had during those hearings, it is a critical API issue. And since it's our hospital, and we're, you know, there's a number of issues in here, including the health and safety of the people there, and that the police will not arrest the people from there because they figure if they're there, then it's...
They're not responsible.
They're not responsible, and so they won't take them to jail, even if they're assaulting nurses. So there's some coordination that we need. We may need somebody from public safety here, too, to find out what that coordination is going to be. And like I say, I'm not wanting to ask people to go on the spot and get answers today to this, but it raises a huge issue to me, and I would like to see us. When is our next meeting? Next week?
No, it's
August 30th.
August 30th, yes.
Well, Madam Chair, we're going to be here next week. Why don't we have a meeting next week?
On this specific subject.
I think it's so critical. Well, that
critical, but we got bigger fish to fry.
Well, if we have bigger fish to fry, that's fine as long as we're frying. But if we're sitting around waiting for another committee to do work, and we're here in Juneau.
Why can't we have a meeting on this no matter what anyway? We may have a bigger fish to fry. I'm fairly sure that next week we're not going to be spending... any of us spending 12 hours a day working on?
Well,
I don't think so.
Let me make a little bit of comment first, that I've done a little bit of checking into this too. And in our session, we put money in for the state employed nurses to get raises. However, there was only enough for 9 months. So these nurses that are, the reason API doesn't have as many people is because they don't pay as much as the private sector, and so the nurse, why would you go over there, you know, when you can get more pay somewhere else? And well, it's more than that, obviously, but one of that is one of the things, you know. And so anyway, they don't get their raises, which we were hoping it would be the 1st of July. They don't get them till the 1st of September, and unless something else has happened since then. Commissioner?
Madam Chair, I can update you that the Department of Admin is doing a market-based study for nurses' salaries around the what they call the family of nursing job categories. And I believe that will be done the end of July first part of August, the last I heard, and then they will make our nurses in the department salary increases retroactive to July 1st.
Okay.
So I'm happy to schedule a meeting whenever. We may not have all those pieces of information, however, by next week, but we could do a preliminary discussion if you wanted to do that and go from there.
I think it's serious enough that, because what's going to happen, they'll lose enough people that they'll have to shut down beds because they won't have enough to cover. In fact, they don't really have enough to cover them now. And I feel that if the people working are feeling that their safety is at jeopardy because of it, then we really need to take some kind of action. So, I don't have a problem at all calling a meeting next week and trying to get more involved, because I feel concerned that when we had the discussions on the no overtime for nurses, that we were told that really wasn't happening, and now we're hearing that there's more happening than we realized at the time. So I'm very concerned, and this is important for not only their safety but for the patient's safety too. Representative Sisson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In all of the discussions that we've had for actually quite a few years now about nurses and the shortage of nurses and the expense of the shortage of nurse, what has always been under, I think, focused on is retention issues. And you know, it's one thing to develop nurses and to get them out of school, but we lose lots of nurses because of the nursing environment. And the studies that I've heard recently are that nurses, actually the wage is not as important as the conditions of employment. And Madam Chair, you had a piece of legislation that did talk to conditions, but some of the conditions are mentioned in this letter. These are state employees, and I think if the state doesn't set a high bar, then I don't think we can expect the private sector to set a high bar either in quality environment for nurses. And if we don't do that in this state, we will lose them to other states and other countries. We've got to fight for them.
Well, and I've actually went to API and toured it. So I've been there. I've seen what's going on and talked with some of the people that are there. So this is Wednesday.
Madam Chair, one suggestion I might have is that we could work to try to schedule something. I'm not sure what our behavioral health director's schedule is or what our API director's schedule is, so I would hate for us to set something here and then have to change it. So if the committee was comfortable with that, we could work on scheduling
it. We will do that separate from this meeting, and I will get back to you all on the committee, but we will meet, and I don't know for sure when, and that is important because there's all kinds of conferences going on across the nation and everything that everybody's trying to go to, so I'll get back. We will be here next week, so let's, I don't have a problem with that at all, working that out.
Sure.
So, Reverend Seaton.
Yeah, and I just wanted to make sure that everybody realizes I don't want this turning into a wage discussion. I mean, this discussion, this paper is talking about, people coming in, and if they have insurance or they're the military, they have to get assigned
standard
to different people, to different groups, because we have advanced nurse practitioners supervising some patients, and which is not allowed by insurance or the military. And so if we are having a situation where we have, if this is correct, and that's why we'll need to get the other stuff, but if we have situations where if anybody from the military, anybody that's covered by private insurance comes into API, they cannot be assigned on the regular random groups because the insurance company or the military will not cover that expense, it means that at least those two groups, which are pretty significant, must be saying the standard of care is not being observed. And I think the state could have huge liability if we're assigning other people
to a lower standard
of care. And so I'm not, we've got this letter, and I'm not saying that, we need to look at it, we need to get the information, but if that is happening, we need to make some rapid adjustment. Otherwise, we're going to have some huge liability problems, especially since, we had a suicide up there. And, you know, if these things start coordinating or kind of being connected, if they are, I'm not saying that they are, but, I mean, we could look at severe liabilities. So,
Commissioner?
And through the chair, I appreciate Representative Seaton giving this to me this morning, and in doing preliminary checks over the BlackBerry with my staff, we have not had this information before, so it will take us a little bit to trace down all the issues. But I really do appreciate your bringing it forward, and we certainly do want to address it.
Okay. What I'm going to do is gavel out. Carl, did you have?
Just a brief one. I just came back from visiting my daughter in Washington State. She was a psych major. She works for the state of Washington treating troubled children. And I have heard stories just like these about underfunded, understaffed, unable to literally do the job that's being asked of them. I kind of suspect this is pretty much of a nationwide problem, and cutting costs by simply removing money from those areas that deal with mental health. And it may be something that we may, if we do anything at all, it would probably be a pretty good standard for the country. But right now, according to my daughter, it's troublesome.
Ultimately, Madam Chair, if I may.
Representative Sisson?
Thank you. Ultimately, cutting costs short-term usually means big costs later.
Yep. Okay, we are adjourned.